Some music there by Brian Eno, which seems a nice way to set the scene for our next discussion. The reviewers think the world of the Australian writer Gerald Manane. One calls him a genius, the writer widely considered to be the next Australian winner of the Nobel. Peter Craven, who's one of our best literary critics, says no living Australian writer has higher claims to permanence or a richer sense of distinction. And a bloke called Blair Marnie, who's a reviewer on Goodreads, just says that Gerald Manane's a treasure. He's 75. He's here with his 11th book. It's called A Million Windows, which comes from a line by the American writer Henry James. The house of fiction has not one window, but a million. And this is, it's a strange and dreamlike book about a writer who is constantly reflecting on the act of storytelling, even as he tells us a story. Gerald, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Nice to have you here. Congratulations. It's a lovely book. It's actually a lovely book to handle. Did you feel that when it arrived? It just had this lovely sort of weight to it.
Everybody praises the cover. I had a different cover in mind, but that doesn't matter.
Publishers are like that. They say, mate, the publisher is out. The cover is our call, I know. So let's try and help the reader get a sense of what you've created here. So the book unfolds in a house. And it's a sort of dreamlike house that really could only exist in the story. Can you tell us briefly about this house?
Well, the narrator of the book itself explains early in the text how the book, or the idea for the book, came into being. He, and I always use the word he, even though it's a first-person narrator, it's certainly not, it's only a version of myself. He was leafing through an old Time magazine, and he saw a page on cinema, and cinema is something that he claims not to have been very interested in, but the name Ingmar Bergman caught his eye. In fact, the name's not mentioned in the text, but just a Swedish director. And he learnt from just glancing at the text that Ingmar Bergman was making in his old age one last film. It was set in a castle, and in every room of the castle was a character from one of his films. And I thought I'd stop writing. I'd only write when I feel the pressure to write, and I didn't feel under pressure. This was only a couple of years ago. And the idea came to me that a book could be written which the setting for which would be a house, or a large house with many rooms, and in the rooms would be not just characters or from other books of mine, but the narrators, the different personae that went into that, or that were responsible. And then I said, no, that would be too hard to do. And I put a little note in my archives, which is all my thoughts, and I don't keep a diary, but I put records of my projects and so on into my archives. I said, this book doesn't deserve to be written. It's too hard. I need a rest. But the idea kept at me, and I wrote the book. It's the house of fiction. I don't have to say, but it's a metaphor, and probably the theme, which not many reviewers seem to have picked up on, is that of all the things that are needed for my sort of fiction, the most necessary ingredient is a thing that I call simply trust, a relationship that grows up between reader and writer.
Yeah, so the narrator talks about trust. I'll just read the section. The narrator of this present work of fiction is one who strives to keep between his actual self and his seeming self and his seeming reader such seeming distances as will maintain between all three personages a lasting trust.
That sounds like my writing. Yeah.
That's the way you write. There's a lot of that in this book. So you've got to kind of get into the rhythm of that. I mean, it's one of those books that tests the reader a bit early, because when you start to read it, to be candid with you, Gerald, you think, oh, my Lord, what is this? And then it's one of those books that you either surrender to and let carry you along, and it takes you into marvellous places, or I guess you say, I can't do this, it's too hard. But let's talk about trust, because you raised that topic. Actually, I was just showing off that if other reviewers had missed it, I'd actually written it down and raised it as question six. I was going to come to it just a moment later. But do trust. Off you go. It's trust. You have the floor.
Well, I instinctively developed this theory or belief in my early writing years, but when I finally read Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past, I found in his words the words that I needed to explain my theory of fiction, to call it that. And it goes something like this, that fiction exists so that people who normally might not be able to connect or with each other, confide in each other, relate to one another, can do those things. And I mean by that that I seem to be someone who can, when I'm writing fiction, give word or express things that I wouldn't normally. It's not just myself. I'm sure that the same could be said for many a writer. I'll try another way of putting it. I prefer writing, even letter writing to people. I prefer writing to any other method of expressing myself. I couldn't tell you the true I won't understand what's really going on in this little interview between us until sometime afterwards, and then the only way that I could probably express it would be in writing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. Because it's a way of nailing things down. They don't jump around. They're not elusive anymore, and you've got to shape them and give them form. And connectedness, that's another key word that comes up a bit in the book.
Connectedness I started to express in my, I think it was my fifth book, Inland, a little dictum which goes something like this. Everything is more than one thing. And I think while I was writing that, I must have been performing over and over again a simple mental exercise which consisted of my focusing my thoughts on an image, let's say in the case of Inland, it might have been a fish pond, which is a central image, and I couldn't hold that image for long without its melting into another image or leading me sideways or diagonally to another image. And in the case of Inland, the other image was a well on a country estate in Hungary, and the two things were connected, a well and a fish pond. And I think that anyone could practice this little do this little test on themselves, that things are connected in strange ways that we don't at first recognise. And my greatest satisfaction as I wrote that book was in discovering connections that I hadn't been aware of before I started. An example is, and this would only make sense to someone who's read the book a clearing in a forest. A film was mentioned at the beginning, a Bergmar film. I can't even remember the name of it. I think the word spring was in the English title, The Virgin Spring. A girl is raped and murdered in a clearing in a forest. And I wrote that early on the book. And almost in the last pages of the book, I found myself writing about another forest on the other side of the world and a clearing and another rape that took place in that forest. And the magical connectedness of all that, it was enough satisfaction to justify my writing the whole book.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart, and it's my very great pleasure to be sharing this conversation with you with Gerald Munnane, who's written a new book called A Million Windows, a book he didn't expect to write, and a book that really does draw together, well, a life's work. That's what it does. It somehow summarises what you've been all about all these long years. Now, you say, well, the narrator of the book, who's a little bit like you, says that he is impatient with books that lack a narrator. I love this. So the narrator of your book is critical of a Nobel Prize-winning South American novelist, explaining that, quote, the author of a text lacking a narrative presence is guilty of posturing, or more likely of incompetence, which I thought was really putting the boot in. What's so essential about a narrator? If you can speak on the behalf of your narrator.
Once again, I for years would have struggled to put this into words, but through a fairly wide and diligent reading in my 40s and 50s, I found, as I found in Proust, I found in an obscure American writer the words to answer what you've just asked me. I was reading a collection of, what was Melville's first name? Moby Dick.
Herman.
Herman Melville. Herman Melville's short stories, which weren't particularly impressive, but I read them through, but the reward for reading them was that in the introduction, an American whose name I've forgotten said, good fiction, or whatever adjective you used, the satisfaction that comes from fiction comes from two things: from knowing that such things might have happened, and from knowing what it is to know that such things might have happened. And the double benefit, you could send me into the next room and I'd come back later in the day with a little short story or 20 pages of a novel which might tell you that about certain things that might have happened. But if it lacked a narrator, that's all you'd get from it. Once upon a time, or you know, Mari said this to Cynthia and Bert said this to Albert or whatever. But the presence of a narrator informs the reader, not just, as I said, that certain things happen, but what the narrator feels, concludes, derives from telling of such things. I always think of Thomas Hardy. When I'm reading a Thomas Hardy novel, as I frequently do even nowadays, I know what's happened or might have happened, but I also have a sort of mental vision or an understanding of a figure like Hardy himself, an older, wiser man, an unhappy man contemplating the things that might have happened.
That's true. You feel as though you're in Hardy's hands when he's telling you a story. I totally understand that.
Well, that's the sort of narration that I value, and the other sort of narration I call documents that fell off the back of a truck. And it's the man's not named in A Million Windows, but he was Mario Vargas Llosa, and I used to read the Times Literary Supplement faithfully in those days, and I was so eager to get my hands on this marvellous first novel of his, The Peruvian, and it was simply, as it's described in A Million Windows, it was simply just streams of narrative that, with no attribution, sort of monologues just beginning nowhere and getting nowhere.
Gerald Munnane is my guest here on Books and Arts this morning, and we're talking about his new novel, which is called A Million Windows. There's a recurring image in your book of light hitting, this is the quote, sunless distant windows like spots of golden oil. And as several commentators have noticed, that phrase is borrowed from The Watcher on the Cast Iron Balcony, which is an autobiographical novel by the Australian writer Hal Porter. Why this veiled reference to Hal Porter?
It's partly explained early in the text. I read The Watcher on the Cast Iron Balcony at a time, the year was 1966. I took years to finish writing Tamarisk Row, which was my first published book, almost 10 years on and off, not permanently at it, but I'd put it away and start again. And something in the frankness and vividness of the first-person narration in Watcher on a Cast Iron Balcony, something in that book got me going again. I find it strange now. It's not a book that I'd want to read again, but there was something, as I said a minute ago, of the vividness and the imagery, and that distant window, the sunless spots of golden oil, it stayed with me when I'd forgotten almost all the other details in the book. And I place a great... If I can only remember one detail from a book, I set great store by that. I try to learn from it. There must be some reason. And it goes back, and again there's a mention of it in A Million Windows, to my first views of the plains of the Western District, where the houses are set back, travelling by bus across through places like Skipton and Derrinallum. The houses are set far back from the road, and you might at late in the afternoon just glimpse one flash of light on a window. It's all you see of a whole way of life in a big house.
The Western District of Victoria. Yeah. Well, it takes on a slightly creepy resonance for me, because what came out about Porter after he died, a decade after he's died, was that the writer Mary Lord published a biography of him in which she revealed that Porter had sexually abused her own 10-year-old son. And knowing that, when you read The Watcher on the Cast Iron Balcony now, it is, well, I can't read it without knowing this. I can't without feeling that it's some kind of defence of paedophilia, because the premise of the book is that the young man, the young boy, the young self, is sexually knowing, and that he grows into a kind of sexual innocence, which is a kind of paedophile's defence. And that resonates with one of the themes of the book, of your story, of your work of fiction, and that is a story of sexual abuse? Because we should explain there is a story in all this. It's not just philosophical reflection on fiction. There's also a story being told. Can you talk about how what that's doing in the story?
I literally, truly did not know what you told me. I can remember that in Watcher on the Cast Iron Balcony, there are episodes of sexual connection between the young Hal, the young narrator, and a teenage boy,
yeah,
the
local
teenage up in Bairnsdale.
Yeah.
And I always had, I was always aware that Porter was what we'd call bisexual. But that, until you mentioned that now, that wasn't, I had no thought of that while I wrote. It's just another example of many spooky examples in my life of connections that I've, that actually lie just outside the scope of my sort of vivid awareness. But I think of Porter more as a heavy drinker. I met a man once who was reputed to be a heavy drinker, but who had to go to bed for a day after having been drunk under the table by Hal Porter. And there's a little sub-theme of alcohol. Beer is mentioned and drinking is mentioned quite a bit in quite a few times in A Million Windows. And Porter died, appropriately, when he fell down drunkenly on a road in Ballarat, where he'd just moved at the age of 70 and was run over by a car. I shouldn't be laughing.
That's not funny. It's not a work of fiction. It was a man's real life.
But that was the connection. But it wouldn't jar me, surprise me, or it wouldn't conflict with my understanding of my own work to know just what you told me.
Now, we do need to wind up, Gerald, but I just wanted to ask you this. I fear I may be what you call an undiscerning reader, because the first writer I thought of when I started your book was Italo Calvino. And I have to tell you, I felt that my life had turned a corner when I was a young man. I read If on a Winter's Night, a Traveller. So when I started your book, I was enjoying being back in the kind of smart, self-reflective world of writing. And suddenly I got told off for seeing such a resemblance. So as if you'd anticipated what I was thinking.
Don't feel badly. I was bowled over by Calvino when I read him. But I truly believe now, as the narrator believes, the narrator of A Million Windows believes, that there is more to writing fiction than confusing the reader or tying the reader in knots, baffling the reader, and it's the human presence, the human trust relationship that matters more. But I was a bit hard on Calvino, I think.
Well, it wasn't you. It was the narrator who's a bit like you. Isn't that the way out?
Oh, thank you, Michael.
Yeah. Gerald Linnane, thank you for being my guest here this morning. The book is called A Million Windows. It's published by Girimondo, which is a very special kind of publisher, I should say. It was founded in 1995 by the Australian literary academic Ivor Indyk, and the company says that its mission, this is on its website, is to encourage innovative and adventurous work that might not otherwise find publication because of its subtle commercial appeal. Isn't that a great choice of words? Across Australia, this is RN. You're listening to Books and Arts Daily.